This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
they need to get a clear fiscal policy to stabilize it. The transitional government, if it is anything to go by for now, it should be expanded to include professional groups, membership groups, the church, the women league. And, you know, women and children have taken the biggest brunt in this war. And this is something that needs to come to the table.
That's political analyst Holid Charles Atiya on the decision to extend the peace process for South Sudan by 100 days. Details coming up also. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is promising to create the best investment conditions for the country's ailing economy. However, not everyone is optimistic. And a local NGO is accusing government officials and police of fueling human trafficking in Uganda. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, South Sudan's president and chief rebel leader agreed yesterday to postpone formation of a unity government for another 100 days, the third such delay in the country's tangled peace process. Some analysts believe the sides still will not be able to bridge their differences. Halima Atumani has more from Kampala, Uganda, which hosted the talks.
At the meeting in Entebbe Thursday, the two South Sudanese leaders once again asked regional bloc IGAD if they could delay forming a unity government. The meeting, attended by South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, opposition leader Riek Machar, and Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, noted that critical tasks related to security arrangements and governance have not been completed. Sam Kutesa is Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs.
The meeting agreed to extend the pre-transitional period for 100 days, effective from the 3rd of November 2019, and to review progress after 50 days from that date, and the report be submitted to the heads of state and parties.
The two warring factions in September 2018 signed a peace deal that was overseen by the United Nations, the United States, and regional governments. The parties also agreed to establish a mechanism for the guarantors and the parties to supervise implementation of the pact. The agreement calls for creation of a unified national army as well as a transitional unity government. Political analyst Tolit Charles Atiya said the process needs financial support and more involvement from South Sudan's political stakeholders.
They need to get a clear fiscal policy to stabilize it. The transitional government, if it is anything to go by for now, it should be expanded to include professional groups, membership groups, the church, the women league. And, you know, women and children have taken the biggest brunt in this war. And this is something that needs to come to the table.
The civil conflict that erupted in December 2013 has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced more than 4 million from their homes. Chair Manyanga Twech, a South Sudanese refugee leader in Uganda, says he and fellow refugees are skeptical the delay announced Thursday will result in real progress.
In Uganda here, we have almost nearly a million for the refugees. But these people here, they need to understand this 100 days. But to the South Sudanese people, it is just a waste of time. To me, there nothing will be done after 100 days.
The new deadline for forming a transitional government is February 20 of next year. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
South Africa's much-publicized investment conference has kicked off in Johannesburg with President Cyril Ramaphosa promising to create the best investment conditions for the ailing economy. However, not everyone is optimistic that Africa's powerhouse will attract enough investment to turn around the pressured economy. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, the investment drive is facing a mountain of challenges.
South Africa is open for business. This is the key message delivered by President Cyril Ramaphosa at the ongoing investment conference. Hundreds of delegates from around the world have gathered in Johannesburg to hear more about opportunities in mining, agribusiness, infrastructure development, manufacturing, and other sectors. Ramaphosa told the delegates he is hoping for an economic win following the national rugby team's victory at the World Cup in Japan.
Now, that achievement has inspired our nation to reach for greatness, to reach beyond the limits of the present towards the boundless opportunities of the future. It has demonstrated the power of a shared vision and common purpose.
But South Africa's investment drive is facing a steep hill. On Friday, rating agency the Moody's downgraded the country's credit rating from stable to negative. This is likely to cause investor fatigue. Last month, the unemployment rate catapulted from 27 to 29.1%, bringing the total number of unemployed people to over 9 million. The Minister of Finance recently slashed the economic growth prospects by 70%. But Kelvin Board, a young business lab manager at Naspers, insists there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, there might be all those challenges that we are facing as a country, but I firmly believe that we're going to be changing so many things in South Africa by the year 2030.
Some economic analysts believe Ramaphosa's record so far as the president could work in his favor when investors weigh their options. His resolve to fight corruption has been applauded by many, although there are also concerns that there are no tangible steps taken so far to bring to book those found to have committed acts of corruption. Don Mashele, head of business development impact support at the Small Enterprises Finance Agency, says Ramaphosa's frankness about the problems facing the country is exactly what investors want.
If you admit to say that we had these positives, we have challenges, but we are correcting them, that's leadership. Denial to me is not the right way to do it. You need to be transparent about the challenges. You need also to be transparent about what practical solutions are you putting in place to correct the country.
During the conference, dozens of local and international companies have already announced investment commitments worth millions of dollars. Colin Coleman, Chief Executive Officer responsible for Sub-Saharan Africa at Goldman Sachs, a financial services firm, says the government's huge wage bill and continued bailout of public enterprises is a huge problem that needs urgent attention. He, however, says Ramaphosa has showed convincing determination in the way he has handled the economy so far.
Obviously, with this right structure reforms, which the president is trying to promote, and including with this conference, we should see a tick up in growth. Hopefully, in the short term, more towards 2% growth rates. But with doing the right things, we should get back to the 3% growth rates that we've seen on average in the last 25 years.
The government is expecting to raise $100 billion worth of investment in the next 5 years. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Africa's smallholder farmers are well known for their resourcefulness and ambition. What they often lack, however, are reliable online markets and the technology to reach them. Enter Ghana-born economist Yao Niarko of New York University. Niarko directs the Center for Technology and Economic Development with branches in New York, Abu Dhabi, and Ghana. The centers develop mobile apps, build commodities exchanges, and conduct research geared to Africa's smallholder farmers. In a recent conversation with VOA's Adam Phillips, Niarko explained his center's optimistic rationale.
I have a lot of confidence in our smallholder farmers, for example. If you give them markets, if you design a system where should they produce, they will get guaranteed sales, they are going to perform miracles. The problems in economic development in Africa, many times the government comes in and messes around with the price system, overtaxes them, fails to design markets, infrastructure. But if we can have trust in our farmers, they don't need aid. They need markets.
How do you build trust?
You build trust in the institutions. For example, I've been associated in Ghana with designing a commodities exchange. Believe it or not, our smallholder farmers who produce corn and other grains have no centralized market. It's the same as Chicago maybe 150 years ago, okay? Last year, November, we opened one. That was one of the things I'm very proud of, that my center helped the Ghana government think through all of this and open it. And what it does is that it provides the farmers security. If they produce their maize, if they get it to the warehouse, they get a piece of paper. And that piece of paper, they can sell it and get their money. Current system, they'll produce their maize. Maybe nobody will show up at their farm gate to buy it. They give it to somebody who says, I'll pay you something later on. The person vanishes. The person doesn't give them the right money. These are all issues which mean that there's a lack of security. You ask me, what do I mean by security? That's what I mean.
I understood you had a visit from the president of Ghana.
Yes, the president came to our center 4 days ago. He had heard about the things we are doing, and, he walked into our center in the village, in the heart of smallholder agriculture. And as he was walking in, first we showed him some of our drones. And what they do is they take pictures of farms. Some of these farmers had never seen a picture of their own farm.
Why is it useful for a farmer to look at their own farm?
Well, it gives them a sense of the good areas, the bad areas. They may not have realized that the fertile area of their farm is much bigger than they thought. The rocky area is much smaller than they thought. And you could see brain waves, ticking as we were showing these pictures. Oh my goodness, maybe I should spend more time on this part of the farm, maybe making this kind of commodity. After the drones, the president picked up one of our mobile phone apps. The app itself is not that sophisticated per se, but it's a method in which farmers can trade. Just imagine, you're a smallholder farmer. You're thinking about expanding your farm. Your biggest fear is that you will put all the effort into making the maize, the plantain, or something else. You hire people to weed your farm, to collect everything, fertilizer, spraying, take it to your farm gate, and guess what? Nobody shows up. You don't know why they haven't shown up. You're just stuck.
That must be so disheartening and also kind of frightening.
It really is. And, by definition, smallholder farmers, their margins for error are very, very small. When they make a loss, their kids do not go to school. And sometimes they don't eat. Somebody is sick. If there's no money, pray to God. Those are the realities of life of a farmer.
And the app helps with that?
The apps is all about markets. We call it marketplace, and the app does a very, very simple thing. Anybody who wants to sell something, they turn on the app, they look for a picture of what they want to sell, they put in how much of that thing they have, and the price they're willing to sell. On the other side are a lot of people who want to buy from these farmers. They can't find the farmers. The farmers are scattered all over the place. And so what do? They come on our system and they say, hey, if there's anybody around who has maize, who's willing to sell it, I am willing to buy. My job with the app is just to match the two. I want to get it to a place where farmers can understand that regardless of what happens, because of the app, somebody, somewhere will buy their maize or buy their plantains. And so that's all it does. It takes away the fear of not being able to sell their goods with markets.
That was New York University economist Yao Nyarko, the director for the Center for Technology and Economic Development. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. A local NGO is accusing government officials and police of fueling human trafficking in Uganda. Mawazi Sharon, who heads the group Overseas Workers Network, says police officials do not want to prosecute suspects because they are profiting in human trafficking. Police deny the allegation. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakaringi files this report from Kampala.
A mother of two, Sharon Kusasira, says she endured inhumane treatment while working long hours in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. She says she was usually subjected to psychological and physical attacks.
My hands were bleeding. I told my boss I'm in pain. They said you have to work. They didn't give me treatment. They didn't want me to rest. Even food, I didn't eat very well. Only lunch. And that lunch I ate bread and tea. That was my food. My boss wanted to beat me because she told me to clean somewhere. I forgot. She came, she wanted to slap me.
The 27-year-old says she got a placement as a homemaid in Jordan in a year ago, but worked only 3 months, calling the conditions unbearable. With no jobs available in Kampala, Kusasira decided to try her luck in Saudi Arabia in January, but says she found similar conditions. She resigned and was repatriated back to Kampala by Overseas Workers' Voice, a local NGO that advocates for the rights of Ugandans working abroad. Mariam Mwiza, who heads the group, says such cases are all too common, and that her organization has repatriated 94 females from the Gulf countries, notably Oman, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. She says many young people desperate for jobs, especially young girls, are usually trafficked out of the country.
That the victims have got different stories. To the case of women, ladies, they are always sexually harassed. They are beaten. They deny them food. You find a person eats once in a day, and then he eats a half chapati plus hot water with ginger. They overwork. You know, someone working over than 12 hours, someone works up to, let's say, from morning up to the other morning without rest. Then other stories is that they always try to forge cases on them because passports are confiscated and their phones are taken away.
She says some workers never get paid. Mwiza claims the traffickers are usually very connected people, especially members of the Uganda police.
The suspects that we have reported to police stations, number of them, none had ever been arrested.
Twine Charles is the spokesperson of the Criminal Investigation Directorate, a branch of Uganda police that investigates crimes. He acknowledges cases of human trafficking are on the rise, but denies police involvement.
We have got a record of intercepting the girls that are due for trafficking. We've got a record of successfully investigating and causing prosecution of the perpetrators of trafficking in person. Because of our efforts, we have also a record of conviction of some people who have been caught and successfully prosecuted in trafficking in person. Therefore, for somebody to make such glaring statement that Uganda police is fueling trafficking in person, we don't understand the intention, but it is sheer blackmail, mudslinging, our hard-built reputation.
According to police, 286 incidents related trafficking in persons were reported in 2018, compared with 177 the year before. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. As a prolonged drought batters Zimbabwe, causing widespread food insecurity, the South African nation is facing serious power and water challenges from shortage of rain. Adigando gives us more on the story.
Amidst a host of socioeconomic challenges the country is facing, its second largest city, Bulawayo, imposed a 72-hour water rationing schedule a few weeks ago as water levels at the 6 dams which supply the city are dangerously low. Bulawayo dam levels are now at 37.76% capacity. In an interview, Mayor Solomon Nguni said the city is faced with drying up if the rains do not fall and residents fail to conserve available scant resources.
We are almost 2% empty, but if it doesn't rain, we only have 7 months of water in our dams. Yeah, so hoping that rains, well, if it doesn't, then we are in trouble.
One of the 6 dams, Apanema, has been decommissioned, and another, Umzimwane, is likely to be decommissioned if the situation does not improve with expected rains this season. The challenge of water supply to the city is compounded by power cuts.
Well, our pumping and booster stations are usually connected to a dedicated power line. And now with the challenges which Zimbabwe is facing in terms of electricity, we have been asked to at times to disconnect so that we reduce load on the national grid.
According to information posted on the Zimbabwe Power Company ZPC website on Friday, Kariba Power Station is producing just 81 megawatts out of the installed capacity of 1,050 megawatts. Other power stations were also at below capacity, with Harare producing 15 megawatts, while Wange is producing 376 megawatts, bringing it to a total of 472 megawatts. Bulawayo and Munyati power stations are off. Analysts say that Kariba Power Station could be decommissioned due to low water levels. Though government weather forecasters have predicted normal to above normal rains, the southern part of the country, which is traditionally dry, has yet to receive any rainfall. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
A recent report by Freedom House says Zimbabwe's internet space is only partly free. The independent watchdog organization dedicated to the expansion of freedom and democracy around the world cited a number of factors, including restrictive laws and high costs of assessing data. Reporter Kuzai Zanawash has details.
Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Pali, an online publication that covers parliament business and political developments in Zimbabwe. He says the report is truthful.
It reflects very well what's happening in Zimbabwe right now. The cost of data is extremely high. It's also impacting a lot of people. The state of the economy is reflective of the price of data and, you know, profiteering by the mobile network operators. And you just have a situation where the government is just sleeping on the job.
Kudahove is the Media Institute of Southern Africa legal officer. He says many factors contribute to Zimbabwe ranking low in countries with internet freedom.
So the first thing that made Zimbabwe's internet freedom environment deteriorate was the January 2019 internet shutdown, where the internet was shut down for a total of 6 days. That showed that internet freedoms in Zimbabwe are on shaky ground.
He adds that even Zimbabwe's legal framework has laws that can get people arrested for having dissenting voices. Hove says other factors ensure that Zimbabwe's internet is only partially free.
The latest sector performance report that Potras released shows that there's actually a decline in the number of internet users in Zimbabwe. In December 2018, there was an estimated 62% of Zimbabwe's population using the internet or accessing the internet. And that has declined over the past 6 months to the number or the percentage has dropped to 57%.
Hove says this is worrying because internet enables people's rights. When they communicate, they exercise their right to associate with anyone. When one Googles their assignment and homework, they exercise their right to education. When one uses email at work, they exercise their right to choosing a career and earning a living. He says, what's more worrying is how the number of internet users has reduced yet mobile network operators post finance reports that suggest their profits are increasing, which seems to mean that those who remain online are being overcharged. Critics say the presence of pro-government trolls online has also influenced Zimbabwe's internet freedom. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinawashi from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up next, the sunny side of sports. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Tomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.